Hey, everybody. Welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your 4 o'clock news hour show, public affairs show. My name is Eric Mann. I'm usually here with my co-host Damon Azali or Tammy Liu or Manuel Criollo. Today I'm flying solo because they're out trying to change the world while I'm trying to change it behind the microphone. Very interesting show today. We're going to start the show with Mel Weiss, a senior and founding partner of Milberg, Weiss, Burchard, and Shulman, on the serious implications of the Bush administration's tort reform movement. He's been a very successful class action attorney, and I'll tell you about him when we get back. Then we're going to be joined by Dave Zirin, the author of What's My Name, Fool? Sports and Resistance in the United States. He'll join us to talk about Barry Bonds, Major League Baseball's Faith Days and Nights in the Park, Larry Brown, and we'll debate the Knicks and all that stuff, and then racism in sports. So stay tuned for Voices from the Front Lines. We'll be right back. Hello, sisters and brothers. You're back on KPFK 90.7 FM. You're listening to Voices from the Front Lines. This is your host, Eric Mann. A lot of you have heard about the so-called class action suits, especially against corporate malfeasance folks. And Mel Weiss has been one of the leading class action attorneys for more than 30 years. He's a senior and founding partner of Milberg, Weiss, Burchard, and Shulman. He's a leading practitioner in the field of securities, insurance, environmental, antitrust, and consumer fraud. He's had some major settlements with Prudential Life Insurance, Metropolitan Life Insurance, Drexel Milken litigations, and so forth. He was also a lead counsel on the Swiss Bank litigation involving Holocaust confiscations. He was also a lead counsel on recovering $5 billion for German Holocaust victims. And he also played a role in suits against Enron, the tobacco companies in Wall Street, and as I'll get to later, probably a reason why the Bush administration is trying to move against him. Mel, how are you doing?
Great. How are you?
Very good. Very happy to have you on the show. You know, the Bush administration is very clever. You know, welfare reform is getting rid of welfare, and tort reform is getting rid of torts, but the problem is most people don't know what torts are. What is the so-called tort reform? Why the hatred of the Trial Lawyers Association? What's it about?
Well, tort reform isn't designed to get rid of torts. Torts are defined as a legal wrong. So when somebody perpetrates a legal wrong against somebody else, that's a tort. It could be a physical tort. You get punched in the face. You get assaulted. It could be a financial tort where somebody defrauds you. Tort reform, instead of meaning we're going to try to stop people from perpetrating wrongs against other people, is a way of articulating that we're going to stop the victims from getting access to the courts so that they can get their remedies against the wrongdoer.
Right. And under the Private Securities Litigation and Court Reform Act of 1995, passed over Bill Clinton's veto, they began to put more restrictions on the remedies and the procedures. Why don't you tell us about what restrictions were placed on attorneys such as yourselves in trying to win corporate control, you know, reforms on corporate behavior?
Right. This arose as a result of the accounting profession, the auditors, and Silicon Valley crying out that they were being sued too much. And they had to demonstrate that there was an explosion of litigation in recent years prior to 1995 that was wrongfully being brought against those two groups of defendants in order to try to get Congress to make it more difficult for the victims of such wrongdoing to go into court and hold them responsible and accountable, and to also act as a deterrence against future wrongdoing. Now, the problem with the whole approach that they took was that the allegations of their wrongdoing in the past were true, There was never an explosion of litigation. In fact, over the 20 years preceding 1995, the number of cases started as class actions against corporate America and the auditing profession hadn't increased nearly to the same degree as capital formation had increased. But instead, what they said was, we're going to make the pleading requirements more difficult. In other words, you have to have facts and circumstances in great detail in order to survive a motion to dismiss. You can't get discovery into these cases, meaning getting documents produced from the other side or take depositions until you satisfy the court that you already had enough information to pass the standards of pleading, which were very, very difficult. There were many other provisions that were put in there to make it far more difficult for an aggrieved shareholder who bought stock in what they thought was a fraud situation to bring that action.
Well, a lot of times, Mel, when people go to court, you know, a lot of people have a lot of illusions about the courts, frankly, and they say, well, I have my rights. And then they go in, and they don't understand all the procedural remedies that are being cut away. And the issues that may seem technical to some of our listeners are actually the difference between whether or not you can win or lose the case. Why don't you give an example of how the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act, what would be if you were an aggrieved stockholder, for instance, what would be a change in your lack of remedy because of this law?
Well, just to give you an example, let's say a stock following an announcement by a company that they're restating prior financial statements drops precipitously. You would think that after having stated that they're restating their prior financial statement materially or significantly, and that causes the stock to drop a lot, that you would have the right to at least go into court and find out whether or not the prior financial statements were deliberately formulated to mislead the public. Instead, what this law now states is that you have to have specific facts that will be able to demonstrate the date, the time, the name of the people who were participating in the alleged wrong, details about precisely what the financial wrongdoing was and how they went about distorting it, and motive to do it, meaning predominantly that the insiders sold their own stock in order to take advantage of that. They forced you into spending a fortune trying to investigate something that would be virtually impossible to discover the wrongdoing in any event, because you don't have subpoena power, you don't have access into their information as the government might have when they're investigating. So all of these alleged wrongs would not pass muster and would prevent the litigant, the plaintiff who claims that big drop in the stock after a financial restatement, alleging that they think they should be able to go in and find out what that was all about, they would be blocked in their tracks and not be able to do that.
Right.
Because prior to 1995, we could go in and do that examination.
This is Eric Mann. I'm on the phone with Mel Weiss, a leading class action practitioner, focusing a lot on corporate fraud and corporate malfeasance. In one of your law review articles, you talk about little did anyone know that we had yet to see 4 of the 10 largest bankruptcies in history's Enron, WorldCom, Adelphi, and Global Crossing, not to mention the scandals associated with HealthSouth, Kmart, Quest, Nortel, AOL, Time Warner, and Tyco, to name a few. You argue that this had an unintended consequences, the reverse consequences, but does it? I mean, the question to us is, isn't deregulation getting what they want? Right now, with the backdating of stock options, I mean, isn't virtually every day a scandal of which only a few people are going to get caught, and the widespread practice becomes part of new corporate behavior? So where is the unintended consequence? It seems to me they're getting away with murder.
Well, the unintended consequences that I was talking about was as follows. Prior to 1995, very few big institutional investors would take on the cause of these cases and act as a class representative. The Congress thought, because they were persuaded by corporate America to believe this way, that once big institutions got into control of these cases and not the lawyers controlling them, that these big institutions would see that these were frivolous lawsuits and that they shouldn't have been brought in the first place. Instead, what happened was two things. One, corporate America started to feel very cozy and comfortable that these new laws were going to protect them from accountability. So they took far more risks. The watchdogs, the accountants, the lawyers, the investment bankers, the underwriters, didn't do their jobs with the diligence that they were supposed to. And as a result, the frauds proliferated, and they became bigger and bigger. Whereas prior to 1995, most of the corporate wrongdoing were from smaller companies. Post-1995, you saw a plethora of actions being brought against Fortune 500 companies, such as the ones you just mentioned. And the exponential damages that were created as a result of that wrong, of those wrongs, became not hundreds of millions of dollars, but tens of billions of dollars, and in some instances, even more than $100 billion. So those were the unintended consequences that I was talking about. Now, after the aftermath of all of that, which also included corruption of Wall Street and the underwriting community, these IPO cases that I have, where we allege that the entire investment banking community misused analysts or manipulated the opening prices of new issues. All of that proliferated as a result of the sense that the courts would no longer hold these people accountable because the administration was putting in very conservative, business-oriented judges.
Well, let me ask you something, Mel. That I'm on with Mel Weiss. This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. Mel, a lot of our listeners on this show don't own stock, contrary to the Bush theory of democratizing the stock market. They're upset at when they hear about Tyco having a debauched orgy with stock pools of money, but they more laugh than otherwise. If you're a working class person, if you're a public school teacher, if you're a janitor or a security guard, besides thinking it's disgusting, why should you care? Are there implications of cases you've taken that frankly have more of a class orientation for working class people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, just as Exxon Valdez disaster educated people to how corporate America acting improperly could devastate our environment and wildlife within our environment. The Enron case, it was emblazoned in people's minds because they saw the lifetime earnings of the very people you're talking about being destroyed because those people were putting their money into the pension funds that were created by their employer, and the employers were using that money to buy a tremendous concentration of Enron stock, and that was being done predominantly to entrench them in control of those companies, of Enron. So the result was that when Enron failed, you saw all those workers who had their lifetime savings for their retirement, for their kids' educations, destroyed. And that's how they were injured by that bad corporate conduct. In addition, most people today have money in mutual funds. And not only do mutual funds lose as a result of the money invested in corporations being desecrated through wrongdoing, but then we found out that the operators of the mutual funds were also manipulating in order to profit for themselves or for their customers in ways that were wrongful and were hurting people.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, Attorney General of New York, yourself, Arthur Levitt, before he's, I don't think he's as active as when he was SEC. But how many good guys are there right now at a time when, you know, the question is if we're doing the kind of ex post facto suing. I don't see, and I'm going to segue into something, actually, I want to talk to you about. During the 2004 elections, you had a really decent guy, John Kerry, who had been against the war in Vietnam, and then he's attacked under the Swift Boat Group, and he takes a dive. And then you have a decent guy, John Edwards, who, from what everything I understood, was an excellent trial lawyer, made a fortune in trial law, but for generally progressive causes. And Kerry would not defend his own role in Vietnam, and Edwards would not defend trial lawyers.
Yeah, it was disgraceful. Yeah, just as Joe Lieberman and Chris Dodd, because they come from an insurance state, were the leadership of the tort reform movement to try to shut down the access of the average citizen to the courts. I mean, look, the trial lawyers of America, together with the unions of America, were the biggest champions of the working class. Every time something was done to injure their interests, either as wage earners or the conditions under which they worked, whether they were being exposed to dangerous conditions through asbestos or bad mining practices, every time we asserted those rights on behalf of these victims, the other side of the aisle immediately tried to shut down our access to the courts in order to make those wrongs accountable and to deter future wrongdoing. The result is that we no longer have the same size unions, and they also at the same time cut down on the amount of money that was being contributed to the party that typically in the past had sought to protect those interests. Now we're in a really troubling period, because I can't even say that all of our Democratic candidates understand who their constituency really should be. And that's why this fellow Lamont in Connecticut is having a real influence over that election against Joe Lieberman, who not too long ago ran for vice president as Democratic standard bearer. And I think Joe Lieberman deserves what he's getting. He has totally forgotten who his constituency is and the interests of those constituents. He doesn't care about the right of a woman to make her own choice as to whether or not she wants to have the baby. He doesn't care about the interests of unions. He doesn't care about the devastation through the conduct of a bad war. He just seems to be in the pocket of the insurance industry on every one of those issues, and I think he has to be held accountable. Let him become a Republican.
Yeah, or let, unfortunately, most of the Democrats have already become Republicans. But we're on with Mel Weiss, a leading class action litigator, a bulldog, if I can say, against large corporations, highly respected, was involved in Holocaust suits with the Swiss government, try to resolve them effectively in terms of stolen property. In fact, let's take a minute on that. That's really interesting, actually. Tell us about that case. I mean, I think a lot of, you're on KPFK with Eric Mann, 90.7 FM, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. So, Mel, tell us a little bit about that Holocaust case and how you had to deal with the Swiss government, and how did that get resolved?
Well, this is fascinating, because the victims of the Second World War, which ended in 1945, had opportunities, the survivors, that is, to be taken care of by the governments that existed post-1945. It would be very hard for the Swiss to say that they were under the influence of Nazi Germany in 1946 through 1998. But yet, during all of those years, nothing was done to give back the money that the Swiss bankers kept from the refugees coming out of Germany and Austria and other places where the Nazis had their influence, and these people were depositing their funds in these banks because it was supposed to be a neutral country. The same thing with respect to the people who were enslaved by the Germans and put to work in concentration camps in various plants that were benefited, where the big corporations were benefited as manufacturers and the like. And these people were slave laborers who were worked until they died. Now, a certain percentage of them survived. It also included the Eastern Europeans who were not Jewish, but who were captives because they were enemies, and they were put to work as laborers, and they were forced laborers. The Jews, the Romanis, the crippled, of course, were slave laborers because they were worked until they were killed. So 50 years go by, and none of the survivors of all of that conduct were paid for their forced or slave labor, or for the monies that they deposited in the Swiss banks. And every time people who survived or their heirs knocked on the doors of those banks, they were given a very hard time. So at some point in time, we were retained, and the Wiesenthal Institute was one of the ones who engendered this action, who got it started by asking us to start these cases, and the World Jewish Congress and Edgar Bronfman. And we started these actions where? In the United States, where we have a unique justice system. There's no other country in the world that would give these kinds of aggrieved victims access to the courts to try to get back justice, at least some form of justice for all of those years of wrongdoing. The result was that because we were able to start those lawsuits, we gained the support of governments, the United States. There were 8 Eastern European governments that aided us in the State of Israel. And we wound up negotiating in the State Departments of Germany, the United States, to get remedies for these victims. The Swiss government turned their backs on us. The German government, on the contrary, sought to help us. The Swiss banks sought to help us. The German industrial complex, while they paid money ultimately, they treated this just as a lawsuit, not as a humanitarian effort.
Right.
So I learned an awful lot about the character of these different countries on a present-day basis, and also of the companies that operate within these countries. And, you know, it was in some ways very enlightening, in many ways very saddening.
Well, Mel, let me just end with this. You've had a rich career. I'm just starting to follow it as much as, obviously, in preparation for the show, you get to learn a lot. You've obviously been a partner with, is it pronounced Bill Larach? Is that how it's pronounced?
Larach.
So I shouldn't, certainly the corporations know how to pronounce it. You had a 30-year relationship. You about several years ago,
we split
your companies.
About 2 years ago. But prior to that, I founded this firm in 1965. There was never a law firm in America that could stand up to the big law firms that corporate America could retain. And what we provide even today, we have 2 separate firms, is the quality of lawyering and the dedication to the interests of our clients, average people who can't go out and hire the Sullivan and Cromwells and the Davis Polk and Wardwells. They can hire the Milberg Weisses and the Larach Coghlans, and we will have the same kind of strength and intellectual capacity and resources to go after the biggest and the best, the biggest enemies that they can throw in our face. We can fight Exxon Valdez as we have now for 17 years. We haven't received a dime from them. We have a $6 billion judgment for our clients, none of whom, all the fishers up in Alaska, all of the landowners up and business owners up in Alaska, suffered all of that injury. And they haven't seen a dime from these lawsuits in 17 years. But Exxon Valdez can pay Lee Raymond hundreds of millions of dollars for fighting us off over the 17 years upon his retirement.
And Bill, Mel, let me end with this thing, that given the great track record, isn't it ironic that now you're engaged in litigation where the United States Attorney General is moving against your own law firm, claiming improprieties, claiming moving money to witnesses?
Never to witnesses.
To plaintiffs. Wait, let me just finish. I'm sorry I wasn't claiming that you moved money to plaintiffs. And interestingly, suing your entire firm, is that correct? Not just suing individual attorneys for wrongdoing, but suing your entire firm.
Right.
Why don't you end by just, I know you're limited on what you can say, but explain to our listeners just at least what are the parameters and what are you doing to fight back?
The government has indicted my firm. This is after everybody in America, the Chamber of Commerce, the Wall Street Journal, the American Bar Association, has said that entity indictments are bad for our society. They've indicted my firm, in addition to two of my partners, and have made it very difficult for us to get big institutional clients to retain us. So, you know, we're still fighting for our clients, for our people, and if anybody out there needs a strong law firm in a big complex matter that affects a lot of people adversely, we're there for them, and I want every one of them to know that. All they have to do is look up our website, Milberg Weiss, .com, and they will be able to read all about us and call us up at will.
Now, it was very, very nice to have you on the show, and I appreciate it. Good luck in fighting back against the forces of evil. Very interesting interview. That was Mel Weiss. Long history is 1965. He's been involved. We're going to take a quick break. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with our next guest, Dave Zarin.